do the other things. Okay. Hi, guys. Thanks for staying on Thursday. Hi. I'm Cheryl Hammond. I'm an ALM consultant with Northwest Cadence, and I think what that means for me for about the last year and a half is that I spend my time professionally telling people things they already know. But for some reason, they also kind of like that. They especially like it when I can gently point out to them how smart they are about the things they already know, and if they would do those effectively, it would help them a lot. So today I'm going to kind of talk about some stuff that I know you guys already know because at a minimum you've been here. But I want to try to sort of pose it in a new way. So Keith asked me, oh, sorry, and that's my dog. I knew I was going to forget that. That's my dog. No, Keith has nothing to do with the dog, but he's really cute.
Me?
Yeah. My dog has a special affinity for geeks. I don't know what it is. Especially, like, cranky, trolly geeks on the internet. They come and visit my house. He loves them. He hates most of the rest of my friends. He hates the UPS guy. He really hates my yard guy. Geeks he likes. Good taste, I think. Anyway, so when Keith asked me to do this talk about the Agile for Agnostics session, I sort of went back and thought about what did I have in mind when I wrote those fateful words on the big whiteboard in my brand appropriate colors. And what I had in mind was the same thing I think anybody here has in mind, fame and glory for myself. I also had in mind that what we would do is get together at a table and talk about how incredibly frustrating it is when all the dogma and the jargon and the rigidity and the rules about these different agile methodologies get in the way of us being able to use agile fundamental principles to solve real-world problems. I was surprised and dismayed to find that all of the people who showed up for my lightning session wanted to talk about using agile principles to solve real-world problems. I had not accounted for that. I was going to complain. They wanted to actually talk about the actual problems and fix the problems. And so I want to share with you from the bulk of our session, we spent talking about a particular case study. Some awesome guys from ecology, the Department of Ecology in the state of Washington, an enterprise near and dear to my heart because I spent 10 and a half years as a developer for the University of Washington.
We have a couple of people in the audience from there.
So absolutely.
Be sensitive.
I'm a great fan of those. And in fact, I don't think either one of them is in here because I believe they are delivering the lightning talk next door. But I did check in with them and several others from the session before I came to talk here, and I said, here's what I think I'm going to say about you. Is that okay with you? And do you think it's reasonably accurate? And it checks out. And this is going to be taped and available, so I'm accountable to them if I misrepresent their situation. But as I said, the situation in the public sector is something I feel pretty strongly about because I've been there and I've done that. And there are some unique challenges to implementing any form of agile in the public sector, in part because the public sector is not profit-driven. You can say that in a positive way or a negative way. It doesn't really matter. We all know it's true. It might be driven by things that are not measurable like public service, but it is also just sort of driven by, like, money is not really the metric. Maybe it should be, it isn't. And for us who are the line workers and developers in that situation, that's not the sort of thing that we measure by. So we have to think of other things. Bottom line, for these folks, they brought a challenge that is familiar to anybody who's tried to implement any form of Agile anywhere. And that was, gee, guys, we're trying to do Scrum, but one of the things we find really disruptive about Scrum is that we can't control the scope of our iterations because we get a lot of unplanned work, we get a lot of interruptions. And folks come in from different parts of our organization and they tell us we need to do this thing right now, and we're just developers, we can't say no to them. So what do we need to do? Like I said, it's a really familiar problem. And so we kind of talked through it, and it didn't take a lot of time for the assembled personages at the table to dig in, and we all kind of agreed that the root cause of their problem was the lack of a product owner, to use the Scrum term. They didn't have single wringable neck. They didn't have a person accountable to them to their stakeholders, who could juggle the fact that they had a number of competing departments and agencies all asking them for things who were all stakeholders. Without a strong product owner, Scrum starts to break down pretty quickly. And there's a good reason for that. You kind of need one. It's not, Scrum didn't invent that concept, I don't think. They certainly made it much more clear by wrapping some words around it and putting it front and center in the framework. But the idea that you need some accountability within your organization and that you need some decision-making capabilities and that somebody who is not a code writer needs to be able to go and talk to stakeholders and get them to balance their priorities so that you can figure out what to tell the development team to do in a coherent manner, that's something that we need. Scrum did a nice job of encapsulating that into some words that we can throw around and kind of achieve a shared understanding of what that concept is. One of the things that frustrates me is that sometimes we all get so accustomed to talking about that role that we do not remember how to explain what I just explained to you that you already know. We say product owner, we have to have a product owner, but the people in the room who've never had that conversation, who don't know what a product owner is or why you need one, all of a sudden what we're doing is we're talking about dogma to them. Well, now you have to have a product owner because somebody at Scrum tells you that you have to have a product owner. And I think the folks at Scrum.org would protest and say, it's a framework. Yeah, you know. I think that that is not something that they would say, you know, we're not making rules, we're not telling you what to do, we're just saying it's not going to work very well if you don't have somebody accountable for making decisions. And that is a true statement. How that ended up manifesting in our session was, well, golly, guys, if you don't have a product owner, you can't, Scrum's not really going to work. I think true statement. So therein lies the problem, because these guys are like what I was when I worked at the University of Washington, and that's, they're developers. It's not like they have a say. They don't get to go hire a product owner. They don't get to tell their boss or their boss's boss or whatever level that needs to be at to please be a product owner. They can absolutely educate and encourage. And that is something that they should do. And we heard their tales of woe about how they've been trying to do that. It's not been successful. There is a person that is a good fit for that role, and they don't want to do that job. So they said, what are we supposed to do? And the problem is, when we have zeroed in on our favorite framework, whatever it is, whatever name it goes by, and our favorite piece of that framework that would solve that problem, if we don't remember for ourselves our first principles, why is that piece there in that framework and why is that framework useful? We don't have the ability to do this granular problem solving. So the answer, well, golly, if you don't have a product owner, Scrum is not going to work for you. There was kind of a, it feels like sometimes there's a period at the end of the sentence there. And these two guys did exactly what they should do in that situation, which was they asked the very sensible question, yeah, we know. So now what do we do? Because what we want to do is accept that that is going to be our situation. But is there anything else that we can take from Agile that would help us manage that more effectively? We don't really care if what we're doing is called Scrum or not, just we want it to work. Well, once we did that, the table conversation, I think, opened up really well. And I had the pleasure of being able to sit back and shut up, something my teammates at Northwest Cadence do not believe is possible, and let the table kind of have a really cool discussion about what techniques they could use to replace their absent product owner. So we came up with a few things. One idea would be create a big visible display. This is a concept we're bringing in from Kanban. But it doesn't have to be a canonical Kanban board. It just needs to be a something that tells a story that would display in some form the impact of delay when an interrupting story comes in. So they said, gee, we could physically walk up to the board and take the thing that we're working on now down and move it and say, great, Joe, I'm going to move this one so that I can work on your thing. And I said, theater, I love it. And you don't have to be mean about it, right? You don't have to be snarky about it. You just say, yes, 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 let me move that other person's work to work on your problem. Sometimes in the state, they like that. That might be an anti-pattern if that turns out to reinforce the non-desired behavior. Second solution that we came up with for them was the idea that they could print out a report. They said at the end of their iterations, they typically have a lot of unfinished work because so many things have been interrupted. And we said, create a report that itemizes all of the unfinished work. Make that rolling, right? Make it accumulate. All the work that wasn't finished in that sprint, and report that up to everybody who will listen to you and say, gee, guys, here's all the stuff. I said, two purposes for that. One is to let them know that impact, but the other one is to let them know this is a backlog of stuff that if you give us an hour, we'll have a bunch of that knocked out because it's most of the way done. And the final one was the idea of shortening their iterations even further because that limits their work in process, a concept from all the Agiles, and it minimizes the surface of what there is to interrupt. And they like all that stuff. And I don't know which one of those is going to work or if they'll think of a fourth and fifth thing. But they went away from that session with some concrete practices they could use that are not wrapped in jargon. And I feel like mission accomplished. There were some other problems raised at the table that we didn't quite get to. But we've been talking throughout the rest of the session. Whenever I see these guys, I'm like, did you find a fix yet? Portfolio management. No. Anyway, my idea here, and to wrap up on this concept, is that a lot of times, we are so accustomed to talking about Agile the way we talk about it, because we're all here because we kind of have the idea. We drank whatever flavor of Kool-Aid we like. And it is really useful when we need to talk up to management, our great frustration, right? How do we get director level and above bought into these ideas? We have to put them in plain English, in terms that they understand and want to hear. How do we talk down to the cranky developers who say, this is just another flavor of the month. I am tired of going from one methodology to another. Maybe it needs to not be about a methodology or a framework, but to say, gee, guys, if we did a few things at a time instead of all the things at once, then maybe it would be less impactful to you and you'd remember and be able to test things more effectively. And when issues come up, you'd remember what you more recently did. You know, instead of saying context switching, I put that in plain English and it gets across really well. I don't mean that we're dumb and that people don't know what context switching is, but sometimes it's helpful to spell out why is it a bad thing and why should you care? And I love seeing people's kind of eyes light up. Oh yeah, that's that thing I recognize. This all grows out of our experience, right? So in remembering the first principles, it can be a really helpful tool to communicate and to improve adoption of Agile in whatever enterprise we're working in. So I want to thank you guys. That's what I got. That's my contact information. And we'll be sharing more of this at the workshop tomorrow, me and Steve. And thanks so much, Keith, for having me.
Thank you, Cheryl. And thank all of you for dealing with some of the awkwardness of trying to jam four sessions back to back. I think we saw some good content here. Let's take a 15-minute break and then reassemble in this room for Israel Gott's plenary session, and then for Sam, the kind of the godfather of the event, to bring it all home. So let's take a break and then reassemble here in 15 minutes.